personal success is when you work at something and you work and it doesn't feel like work. Your alarm goes off and you're not dreading it. Your alarm goes off and you wake up excited. You're making the decisions day to day to solve the problems day to day, but the decisions you make too, you need to think about sustainability and what's your decision today gonna do and affect 10 years from now. As long as I can remember, I've just been fascinated with animals. I have.
On this week's episode of American Real, we bring you Jared Miller, a zoologist and the television host of Animal Exploration with Jared Miller, a syndicated TV show that has aired since 2010. In the documented series, Jared is a personal tour guide to the world of animals as he visits various zoos around the country, providing a close-up view of featured animals. Jared is a talk show favorite and is a regular on Rachel Ray, but has also appeared with Jay Leno, Jimmy Fallon, Conan O'Brien, Jenna Bush, and Dean Cain, to name a few. He has been mentored by Jack Hanna and has been fascinated with animals for as long as he can remember. So sit back and relax as Jungle Jared, Animal Explorer, takes us along for a walk on his remarkable adventure. Now, if you are feeling adventurous and are interested in your own hero's journey, I'd like to personally invite you to join our Live Tribe group and experience the power of live video. Posting live 60-second videos will help you build skills of confidence, commitment, leadership, and accountability, all while growing your network with like-minded people from around the world. You'll quickly see how turning up each day gives you more clarity, purpose, and transparency in realizing the power of your own story. Build the best you and join our group of high achievers while practicing to be more present and focused. Click on the link below and start your 21-day challenge and experience today. And now, without further ado, I bring to you Mr. Jared Miller.
This is American Real. I am Roger Brooks, and today my very special guest is Jared Miller. You are a zoologist and a television host, as well as a producer and a personal tour guide to the world of animals in the documentary television series, Animal Exploration with Jared Miller. Jared, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Roger. And again, it's a pleasure to see you. It's been a long time. We definitely have quite a history, especially from my time living here in Binghamton almost over 10 years ago.
I can't believe it's been over 10 years, and you've done a lot since that time that you were in Binghamton. And we'll get into that for sure. But I'd love to talk to you about What is it like coming back to Binghamton? You haven't been here in a while.
In a while.
What's your impression of it?
You know, it's amazing. It's like, well, I grew up not far from Binghamton. I grew up in Western New York in the Buffalo area. And Binghamton, much like Buffalo and a lot of our upstate New York cities, you know, a lot of them are going through just this tremendous resurgence. And, you know, they're finally seeing the full potential of what these cities have to offer. And, you know, it's not only is it drawing people to our cities, but also you're just seeing a lot of new things happening in a relatively short time frame compared to past history.
Yeah, right. And I know when you landed in Binghamton, you were just out of school. I think you were 25 years old,
mm-hmm.
and you became the director at the zoo here in Binghamton.
I know, it was such a weird dichotomy because I was very, you know, very young. I did have an early start. I started working, my passion for animals started, I think, you know, it was innate since I was born. I just, you know, I grew up just loving nature, loving animals, had a slew of pets, and really was attracted to not only what it took to care for animals in captivity, but to explore the world and learn as much as I can about all just the wondrous creatures we share the planet with.
And what was your experience like here as director?
You know, it was fantastic. You know, it was. I would say it was probably one of the most rewarding, but yet one of the most challenging undertakings that I've ever had. You know, at the time, the Binghamton Zoo, I was the third director that was hired at the time. And within 3 years, it was a very short amount of time. And so coming into anything, you know, it was almost like a school of hard knocks. It was, you know, it was basically getting a management MBA while on the job. It was really, really amazing experience. So when I came to Binghamton, yeah, you know, I wasn't too familiar with the zoo and I was just new to the area, but I remember I just had made so many good friends, a lot of friends like yourself that I have to, you know, to this day, that just really made the experience phenomenal living here. Then the job itself, I mean, it was a big charge. It was a challenge. We had to do a lot. It was a zoo that not only, and again, the dichotomy was I was a young zoo director at one of the oldest institutions, zoological institutions in the entire country. The zoo is, what would it be, about the third or fourth oldest zoo in America, going back to 1865. Isn't that amazing?
It is.
And that's one of the other characters I love about Binghamton. Binghamton is just such a rich history, and people just really embrace that here.
Yeah. What about the business side of it? By that point, did you really understand or appreciate the business side of a zoo, or was that also a part of your learning?
You know, I came to the table with some knowledge. Again, like I said, I hadn't really started. When I was a kid, I've always had kind of these two sides. I love science and nature and just obviously just super drawn to that. But I also, I think, had a pretty strong business sense. You know, I come from a family that they're all business people. And so I knew the general ability or had the general ability of that. I mean, I had my own businesses growing up since I was 15. You know, I've always just been a workaholic and I've always worked to then kind of provide myself the luxury to do what I love. And what I loved about the experience at the Binghamton Zoo is it was both. I could, you know, really work from the ground up with an organization. And again, we're a little behind the eight ball. When I was hired, it was a difficult time period for the zoo. They were, you know, in the red. Again, it was the third manager within a very short amount of time. You know, there was a lot of organizational structure that had to be worked. We had some, you know, very dedicated employees, and then we had some other employees that really needed to take it to the next level and need some inspiration and some faith that the organization is going to move forward. And in fact, too, and I worked very closely with a great board of directors, but a lot of them were new to it as well. So we were all on the same boat. We basically were taking on a project, you know, like I said, a little behind the eight ball, but within a very short amount of time, I'm confident that we got a lot done.
And I remember at that time, you were also going through an accreditation, which
yes.
Was something new to me at the time.
Right.
For people that don't know about that, can you explain what that is and what that means?
Well, all the major zoos within the country, you have, you know, there's thousands of zoos, but really only a few, about 220 are accredited institutions by the American Zoo Association. And it's funny that you brought that up. So I was new to not only helping and you know, rebranding and building up the zoo just itself, but at that time I came in as a third director and they were up for reaccreditation from the American Zoo, which had been postponed almost 3 years from it, and you need to, from its 5-year point. So every 5 years, you need to get reevaluated. Like, you know, like any, there's a lot of, it's like a trade organization that, you know, helps maintain the highest standards possible. And so we went through that as well. So, and that was almost like having a second job. That in itself is a job of its own.
Yeah.
So we were forced to, you know, combine this. So it was a very, not a lot of sleep during that first year.
I'm sure. And yeah. I'm sure a lot of learning on the job as well.
Absolutely. And it was great too, because we were able to learn, you know, like you said, from the business perspective, just learning to deal with a nonprofit of that size. Also, you know, just so much, you know, so many moving parts in the organization. And people don't realize that a zoo is no different than any other business. I mean, you're in the business of education and conservation and recreation, working with animals, but really people forget that the main part of the zoo, you run that, it's no different than running a shopping center or something. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's the same thing. So we had to do a lot of work, not only to the infrastructure of the zoo, but what was fantastic is that the community really did rally around the zoo. I mean, we tried to put the zoo in Binghamton's citizens' consciousness as much as possible, whether that be, you know, we always had the news out there, we always going to the TV station, we even had some opportunities to do some national exposure as well. And I think that was fun. But what I think was valuable about that is that we had the citizens really started to rally around, where we were able to, you know, the attendance numbers went up, the, you know, obviously donations went up. We were starting to receive donations from Binghamton residents that now live in other parts of the country, writing checks. And so we were able to get the zoo out of the red. And I think what was a big pivotal point, which was really a good indication of our community's support, is from our municipalities. You know, at the time, Mayor Richard Bucci was very supportive of helping us with the infrastructure that the city can do. But also Jeff Cram, who was the county executive for Broome County at the time, he was able to secure some funds that really set the tone. I mean, the zoo, when I first started, just to kind of give you the numbers, is that the zoo cost, at the time, it cost about a little over $1 million just to operate the zoo, between staff and feeding and all the other expenses that it takes to just keep the zoo running. But the zoo was only running at 800. So that was a $200,000 a year shortfall. The county came through, gave a large promise of funding from an original contribution of about $60,000 a year to $360,000 a year, which was tremendous.
Significant.
And significant. And we saw that continue for years on. That has definitely gave the zoo that kind of, what would you call it? Kind of that little kickstart again to then allow the zoo to become more self-sufficient, become more sustainable. And though it's a nonprofit, bringing money and being more profitable, you know, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, no, and I think just from the awareness standpoint, I remember at that time that the general awareness was raised to a level that I've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's maintained, which is nice, where all that hard work that you and others put in,
right,
is still happening
today. Well, the staff was great, and the awareness, and it was fun, and it was a crazy time too, because some of the awareness wasn't always positive. I mean,
right.
There was, you know, let's say we had the wolves escape, we had and I was, every once in a while I would get ribbed for my age or some of the decisions I was making that, you know, people weren't, you know, total agreement with. But I think long term, the decisions we made and what we did at the time really set a good precedence for the future of the zoo.
So, Jerry, take us back to that time. When did you hear about the wolves escaping, and what did you do? What were you thinking
about? It was a total shock. Well, the whole system, so we had these red wolves in the exhibit, and at the time, you know, and this was very soon on the job, and we had a large enclosure, which is a beautiful exhibit, but it was built in the 70s, so much like other areas in the zoo, there needed to be a lot of updating and a lot of things. There was just, everywhere you looked, something needed to be fixed, which we did, and not only do we do that just for the sake of the zoo, but also leading up to accreditation. These things, we were doing things that perhaps should have been done a decade before, you know, just to keep up with the ever-changing standards. It's nothing against any past management. What it's saying is that AZA accreditation standards, they're always increasing. So as an institution, you're always having to just go to the next level. So back to the wolves, you know, it was a very exciting time. We had some pups born, and which, you know, they're a very rare species, or a red wolf. And the wolves, the three pups, as they got older, at the time, I think it was suggested by whatever organization, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, or whatever organization we're working with, the parents were then, I think, moved, leaving the three youngsters, and they were small. When people think wolf escape, they think big, scary, but these wolves were really about this big. They're about the size of a coyote, or smaller, and they were able to figure out how to get out of this just immense, this massive enclosure. And it was terrifying. Like, it's your worst nightmare come true. So, you know, everyone gathered together, staff got together, we were able to recover them, and it worked out. But it was a lot of sleepless nights. And I remember at the time too, it was like, you know, in Ross Park is such a large area, but, you know, there are homes around there. So we'd be getting calls, oh, I got one of the wolves in the basement. So the Binghamton community, I think, you know, instead of, it wasn't really a panic, it was more of just, you know, it became a punchline.
Right.
You know?
So take us back to your childhood. I know you touched on it briefly, mm-hmm. but give us more detail around how did you first become interested in animals? Where did it start? And, you know, how are you still involved with this today?
You know, it was just one of those things. As long as I can remember, I've just been fascinated with animals. I mean, maybe some of it comes along. I mean, I'm an only child. I didn't grow up with siblings and spent a lot of time in the suburbs of Western New York outside of Buffalo. And I did have a great upbringing, and my family was very supportive, and they also provided me just cool areas. We had, within walking distance, I could go in the forest and the ponds and rivers. And I just remember as a kid collecting frogs and snakes and all that stuff and bringing them home and in just getting close to nature. And I do remember I was about 4 years old, I had a great experience, which always sticks with me. And I remember being in the backyard, and I would go out there, and there were deer would kind of congregate. And I remember just staying as still as I possibly could. And I tried to work my way and get as close as I possibly could to touch a wild deer. And this went on for weeks, months. I don't remember how long it took, but I remember being out there, and it was a hot summer day, and I must have just been real sweaty because I had a deer come over and use my forehead like a salt lick.
Okay.
And so that was my first connection with. It's one thing to work with animals in captivity, but to see them, to witness them, or to even interact with them in the wild is unbelievable. It's an unbelievable experience.
Yeah. No, and I could relate. Just this past Sunday, the family and I took a hike up at Binghamton University, and there were several deer around. And, you know, we were fairly close. And it is really neat, I think, to get that close to nature. And especially if you stay calm within their environment, they seem to stay calm as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that is the key. And I think, and even in a zoological situation, we find that as well, is that it's all about us. See, animals have been forced since the beginning of mankind or humankind, our modernization. Animals have always been like second seat to whatever our needs are, and, you know, resulting in habitat loss and species extinction and all of this stuff that's happened. But if people would be more introspective and be like, okay, well, why don't we be more like nature, more like the animals, and work within their parameters, you could be so cohesive, and we can share the planet a lot easier.
Right, right. Tell us, Jared, about some of your people that you've looked up to. I mean, were you looking up to the Jack Hannas of the world growing up? What was that like?
You know, of course, all my inspiration. You know, a lot of kids have different heroes. You know, a lot of my heroes weren't athletes. They weren't superheroes. They weren't this. They were Marlon Perkins from Wild Kingdom. They were Jack Hanna, who years later had become friends with him. And he came to Binghamton to support our zoo. Gerald Durrell, who was a British conservationist. I used to read all his books, watch as much as I could. And at the time, I'm aging myself, Roger, but I can't believe I lived in a time that there wasn't all this information in the palm of your hand. I mean, I literally was going to the library and waiting to watch a specific television program. And it was, you know, I just learned as much as I possibly could. I was obsessed.
Yeah. What are some of your favorite animals?
Oh, of course, and even to this day, you've met my favorite. Remember Mowgli the lemur?
Yes.
So Mowgli's still alive,
really?
Doing extremely well. He just celebrated his 26th birthday.
Wow.
And Mowgli is a ring-tailed lemur, as you met him, and he's been everywhere with me. He went to college with me. He came here to Binghamton with me. He went to California with me, you know. And he resides back here in New York, and he's retired, actually up in the Finger Lakes region with the organization I work with. But Mowgli is he was this little baby lemur that when I was 15 years old, his mom rejected him, and I bottle fed him, and he's been, in addition to just being kind of a cool companion, he's also become like one of the most iconic animal ambassadors out there. Regardless of any of my accomplishments, this lemur has been, you know, starting on your shoulder, Roger, he was on Oprah's shoulder and David Letterman's shoulder and George Bush's shoulder. I mean, he's been everywhere, and people identify this lemur. And what was interesting, he even did the closing at the New York Stock Exchange to help lemur conservation in Madagascar. So that one, and he's still alive and well. I mean, it's unbelievable. So obviously he's one of my favorites. And again, you know, I grab it. It's so hard. I love one of my favorite places is Madagascar, and where the lemurs are native to. And so I love a lot of the species from there. But again, I love everything. I love, you know, the cats. Cheetahs are probably one of my favorites. One of my favorites at Binghamton Zoo, believe it or not, we had a skunk. That was one of my favorite animals. And we also had penguins too at the Binghamton
Zoo,
which they still have. And I still love spending time with them. And I remember we actually took one of the penguins to the White House one time. And I think you and I went on a trip to New York.
Yes.
We had the penguins on the Today Show. They were not only representing the zoo, but I think they were representing the conservation of waterways with Dawn Save a Duck program.
That's
at the
right.
time.
That's right.
So
you've done a lot. So after Binghamton,
mm-hmm.
Tell us what you did. You started to get into producing, and can you fill us in?
Well, leading up to Binghamton, I did have some experience being a guest on different shows and things like that, and starting to really be out there as a science communicator. I just really love bringing my enthusiasm and science, and it's particularly nature, to large audiences. Binghamton Zoo. So being a zoo director is my dream job, and it is still to this day. Prior to that, I worked at the Columbus Zoo and some other zoos, but to really run a zoo is just, it has everything for me. It was very rewarding, the fact that you're caring for all these animals, you're breeding endangered species, you're providing suitable home and learning all the information you're learning, and then on the business side, you're providing jobs for people that are as passionate as I am about animals, and also too for our community. I mean, it's, you know, there's no better way for people to appreciate nature than to see it firsthand. And that was great about the Binghamton Zoo, is we had just such a wonderful, diverse collection, and they do to this day, that really people don't get the chance to go to Africa or Amazon or China, and so anyone can come and get that and see that right here in their own backyard over in Ross Park. But since then, I started developing more television, and once leaving Binghamton, I kind of focused more on production work, where we started, you know, traveling more. We did started the Animal Exploration series, which was started syndicating nationwide and now in 12 other countries.
That's still on, right?
And that's still on, yeah. That's still on to this day in reruns. We haven't produced any new ones in a long time, but you know, we've just produced so much over such a short period of time that I think that series will live on for a little bit longer. Maybe not as long as American Real will, but I'm serious. We'll see how long it lasts. But it's just always something new. And what I find, like I said, being the zoo director, that's a dream job. This is also a dream job too, in a different way, because I get to still, anything I can do to be around animals on a daily basis or be able to travel or continue my education, that's what I gravitate for. And now in a way, working in television, it's my avenue to, okay, you know, I can get to the Amazon, I can go to Africa, I can, you know, and I have a purpose, I got something
right,
to do.
Right.
So.
How does a project like Animal Exploration happen?
You know, it's funny. It's like anything else. A lot of it's just timing. A lot of it is luck. We started this very, very modestly. It was basically, I worked with a distributor. I was contacted, and that I had met years before, and it's amazing. There's a good lesson in this, too, with any businesses. I always find you you never, A, never burn a bridge, ever, and B, you never, in any networking or contact that you make, it might be a decade, it might be 2 decades, but when the timing's right and the stars align, things happen. And this is how this happened. There was a gentleman by the name of Dave Morgan who had a company in South Carolina, or out of South Carolina, called Lynn. It was a television distribution. He distributed shows like Jack Hanna's show and other programming that was information and education. So the federal government has, the FCC has mandated programming for Saturday mornings, whether it be, on your local affiliate, ABC, CBS, NBC in the morning. Instead of infomercials, they need to put educational programs. So I always like to joke, it's like, I'm on TV because the government tells everyone that I'm good, because that's mandated now. But that's where that all came about. So they were looking to fill some of the spot, and I talked to, flew down there, talked to the guys, helped put together a little production crew, some great guys out in California, and we just hit the road and started making episodes. It was pretty low budget, so we were, driving around in minivans and staying in roadside motels. The actual filming process, as you well know, Roger, isn't as glamorous as everyone thinks. There's a lot that goes into it. There's a lot of hard work. There's a lot of travel and loss of sleep. But we were able to produce a lot of great television, and it still continues to this day.
And how many episodes did you do for that?
We ultimately did, I believe, almost 60 at the time, in half hours. And then what was crazy, so that show started out in the success, and we started doing the circuit and promoting it. And then I was approached by Animal Planet to do a series for them called Pet Finder, which was great because as much as I love wild animals, I love dogs are one of my favorite animals too. So, or probably my favorite, as everyone would agree at home. And especially I love the being able to inspire people and encourage people to adopt too, because I'm not against breeding dogs. Purebred dogs are fine, but there's so many dogs out there that need a second chance. There's so many great dogs that are in your local shelter or your SPCA or City Pound even that need great companions. So this show called Pet Finder was almost like the premise of it was almost like a. Like an animal-human dating service in a way. It was a website originally, and Discovery Communications, which owns Animal Planet, bought this website, and it was almost like a Match.com, I could say. You go on, you find a pet, then you put down what your qualification, what your lifestyle is like, and match it up with a pet. So we decided to make a TV show based on this, which was anything from you find a family that This is, you have three kids, the grandfather lives there too, what's the best pet for them? So is it a duck? Is it a dog? Is it whatever? And so we work with the family to find what their best pet would be. And then we give them some options. And in fact, one episode, it was great. A duck turned out to be the ideal pet for this family. We found a couple where a dog or a rescue dog was perfect for them. We found a little girl who we made her dream of getting a horse by adopting a horse. That was a great episode because I remember this girl, she's in Southern California, and she lived with her mom, her single mom, and she had MS or so, something. She had a somewhat of a what do you call it, like a
disability
of some kind. It was, and she just wanted a horse so badly, and she was saving up cans. So we went to the local, the recycling center, and showed up at her front lawn and dumped thousands of cans on her front lawn that were donated by the local community, which helped give her enough money to get her horse. And then her horse also then, not only did she help rescue a horse, but then the horse actually helped her. And I believe she had trouble walking. And I think just by riding the horse and having that relationship with the horse, now that disability is no longer. So that was a great heartwarming show. It ran on Animal Planet back in, I believe, 2007, 2008, something like that. It ran for a full season. And we were going to do another season until another opportunity came up. Then I was contacted by CBS to do a primetime reality show at 8 o'clock on Thursday nights. Survivor, 8 o'clock Thursday nights. If you remember, if you know your television, that's when that's like the best.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, Cheers was
right.
on at that time
right.
and yeah, Survivor and all these, that's unbelievable television real estate. Millions, 60 million people watching. So I had the opportunity to work on a show called Greatest American Dog as their host, and it was reality show, which believe it or not, I wasn't a big reality show guy. Like I know a lot of people got, I never even watched Survivor before, and which was so popular. But I was hired as the host of this series where we had 10 people living almost like in a bachelorette type house, all living together with their dogs. And if, you know, an animal people, I'm myself included, pretty eccentric sometimes, especially people that are really into their animals. So these are people that have pretty amazing relationships with their dogs that, and then we all had them living together, and then they would have to compete with their dogs in different things. So one episode was all about courage, where we had the dogs, they had to meet an elephant. We had dogs sitting, and the dog had to sit there and trust their owner as we had an elephant approach them and take a banana out from underneath between their paws. Then we had them do an obstacle course. We had an episode called My Dog Can Fly, where we had dogs running, and the trainers, and the trust between, and the relationship between the human and their dog was so strong that we had dogs on zip lines running and jumping into midair to get to their owners. It was a blast of a show, and that ran 10 episodes on CBS over that summer as well. And it was just a lot of fun. You know, so I got a little taste of some of that really cool Hollywood type action, but that's living out in California for a while. But you know, I just couldn't stay away from Western New York. I moved back several years ago, and I just been loving living back here on the East Coast. So,
and you have the personality for this, right? I mean, it takes a special person, number one, to be, say, zoo director. But then once you put yourself out there and you're in the community of producing or being a host, you have to have that dynamic personality. Right. And that's what I love about watching, especially Saturday mornings with the kids, is that you really, I mean, you're so passionate about the animals. It comes through the
you know, Roger, it's, and I appreciate you saying that, but it's like, I think I have as much fun, like, talking. I would actually prefer to talk to a little kid at the zoo than I would talking into a camera. But the subject matter is the same.
Yeah.
That was actually my favorite, regardless of the television work, but that was one of my favorite things about the zoo, is just every day just going out into the zoo and talking to our guests, and everyone is just so interested and so excited, not only about the zoo, but also, you know, just about particular animals and the relationships that people get. So I guess my excitement comes from, I draw that from other people's excitement. You know, that's what drives me.
Yeah.
Especially with kids.
Right. What is it about the relationship between humans and animals? There's a connection there that, you know, there's some people that they even tell you, I'm not an animal person.
Right. Exactly.
Right. But what is it? Why are people so attracted to dogs, to cats, to pets?
You know, I think when it comes down to pets, that's a really great question, because, you know, obviously people are attracted to wildlife. You know, there's something in us. There's something innate that we're still wild to. So even though we try to domesticate ourselves and we wear suits and drive cars and, like, you know what I mean? We're as removed from nature as possible. And I think the more people that are removed from nature, you get that. It's like, I'm not an animal person. But when it comes to the relationship between people and their pets, I think that fills something that... It's just sheer companionship, and it's working with something that you don't have to be a people person. You don't even have to, you know, you don't have to even be like a good relationship person or have interpersonal skills. When you have a cat or a dog or something like that, you know, you have an animal that you can have a relationship, which is completely unconditional. Like, that dog is going to run to you, hop in your lap, lick your face. No matter what, the dog's not going to argue with you. The dog's not going to divorce you. The dog, you know what I mean? It's like, there's all these things. There's no, the complexity I think that people have with each other, that complexity doesn't exist with pets.
We could learn something from that, right?
Absolutely. You know, I think, and that's the whole thing too. I'm working on a book now with a friend of mine who's a psychiatrist about what we can learn from animals and applying not only how animals interact with each other, but how animals interact with us, and then apply, almost as a self-help book, how it applies to humans and to improve, like, our relationships, improve our career, improve, you know, our love life, all this stuff. And you can learn so much from watching animals, because they're so raw and they're unconditional. Yeah. And they're not complicated.
So, Jared, is there a lot of science behind the behavioral, you know, discussion that's going to come out of this book? What type of work are you putting into it?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of it, it's going to be a fun read. And again, it's still in such the infancy of us putting this together. But yeah, obviously there is scientific merit to it, you know, whether it be cognition and learning, you know, because animals they have different reasons for their behavior. But also, too, we're going to make it very applicable for people, a fun read. I must say, almost like a self-help book, but like I said, with the help of our animal friends. So.
What's next for you?
Right now, you know, it's really amazing. I've kind of went in a few directions since moving back to Western New York. I continued doing my television work, just celebrated my 13th season working on the Rachel Ray Show.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, it's been, you know, so many episodes and animals and stuff over the years. It's been great. So just kind of continuing all that work. And again, you know, looking for always interested in working within the zoo community as well. Again, always working towards maybe another directorship at some point. But it was interesting. In Buffalo, I kind of went a complete departure over the last few years. I ended up getting, I think I was inspired by some of my friends in Binghamton, like, you know, our mutual friends, like, you know, like yourself, and remember Ari Mizell, sure. And all these. I bought a building in downtown Buffalo.
Fantastic.
And we remodeled it. We made it a multi-use unit. We had apartments upstairs, four apartments on the second and third floors, and then a cool little tavern on the first floor, and I knew nothing. I mean, I've got a business background, but you know, I don't know how to. I wasn't that. We had a gift shop, or we had a snack bar at the zoo. But I remember. But being in the service industry was just such a new thing. So I kind of got into that, and I wanted to challenge myself because it was such a. That's a very scary business to
it
get
is.
Into. It's a very difficult business. But you know, we got into that, and we made a great, very successful business. And I'm happy to say that we just sold it as of yesterday.
Great.
So we sold it and sold the building as well. So thank you. So now. To answer your question, what's next? It's like, I hopefully, 20 minutes, I might know. So
right.
Who knows? We'll see. But to answer that more, I am going to pursue, you know, doing more work. I just got back from New York City. In fact, this morning, had a great relationship with the American Museum of Natural History. We just had a great debate there. And I'm working with a lot of my other, with much higher scientists than I'm starting to work with some of my heroes, which is great. I'm working with all these great scientists, and one scientist I was working with at the debate, we're looking at developing a series together that we're going to travel. So again, there's, you know, a lot of it you can plan so much, Roger, but again, this even like this new opportunity and even this book, I mean, this is stuff that the seed was planted 5-10 years ago,
right.
And again, it's just about timing. So I don't try to push it. I just kind of go with the flow. And when I think when I go with the flow, things tend to happen a little bit quicker than you anticipate if you don't worry about it.
Yeah.
So.
You talked about the Rachel Ray Show, and you've been doing that a long time. Mm-hmm. What type of work goes into something like that? How often do you go there? What's typically the theme? And how does that all come together?
You know, it's pretty diverse, and yourself, we've gone together,
yes.
and it's so exciting, like to see these productions done is just, I mean, there's so many people, and you can tell that there's just such this energy in this. Maybe it's stress, I don't know what it is, but there's all these energies at these studios, especially when we're at the Today Show set, because that's all live and you have millions of people watching and everything.
Yep.
But it looks so great and it just always works. But for, taking Rachel Ray Show, for example, that was a relationship back when I was starting our animal exploration series. You know, it's fun as I kind of progressed in my career with zoology and in television. It's funny, a lot of the friends that you make that are back then that are, you know, going to get you coffee or going to get someone coffee are now executive producers. So it's fun where you keep your friends with you and then
A bridge, like you said.
You never burn a bridge because you never know, because one day your assistant might be your boss, or your assistant might be the gatekeeper to something that you want to do. But what's amazing, so I just kind of grew up with this talented group of young people that, you know, are now in positions that they're running these shows, and I've just kind of gone along for the ride. So, it's so funny, this 13-year run with Rachel Ray was the result of working with a producer on Wayne Brady Show back in the early 90s, and then Tony Danza Show when we went to New York, worked on that show, and then transferred over to Rachel Ray, and it's just, you know, it's funny, sometimes these shows come and go, most shows come and go so quickly,
right.
But when they
stick, they stick. Yeah. So, and I think Rachel, she found her audience. She was perfect at the time, and she's continuing it to this day. And that show has evolved into really an amazing, it's just an amazing series. And my contribution, to answer your question, probably about once a month on average, I find myself down there. And for 13 years, we've talked about everything. We've traveled with the show, and the animals that we've had at the show, almost 200 different species. It's a lot. It's a big undertaking. I think you remember what it takes, even just for our little 8-minute segments. You remember just what it took.
Ton of coordination.
Yep. You know, it's fine when you do these. When you see animals on TV, people don't realize like what it takes, because you need to find something that might fit a particular theme. Let's say you're talking about rainforest animals, so you have to find rainforest animals, determine what that's going to be. Then you have to find an animal that you could appropriately, safely bring into a studio. You have to find a zoo or a handler or education center that has this animal. Make sure they're available to do it. Make sure the animal can do it. There's so many moving parts for that little bit. It's not just putting an animal in a crate and taking it somewhere. Right. There's and then there's all kinds of logistics and permits and all everything that goes along with it. So every time you see that little 5 to 8 minute animal segment, whether it be myself or Jack Hanna or Robert Irwin or all these guys that are doing it now, and at the time it was pretty much just me and Jack. Now mm-hmm. Now you have all these guys doing this stuff, right. But it's a lot. It's a lot of work.
Are there any animals that you don't care for, or that say a snake or something that you...
Yeah, oddly enough, my parents hated snakes. My mom hates snakes to this day, and I used to torture her because I'd bring every snake I could into the house when I was a kid. There's not an animal I dislike, but there are animals that I would prefer not to handle or be around. Bears are one. Bears are an interesting animal. They're fun and they're cute when they're little cubs, but I prefer not to work with them because they... they're expressionless. Like bears with beady little eyes are cute, but a bear, unlike a dog will growl at you, or a cat will hiss at you. And other animals will give some indication before. Bears are expressionless. They'll basically be sitting there looking like you're their best friend, and then chomp. They'll give you a bite. So a bear's a good example. Parrots are the same way too. Some of these smarter animals often outsmart me. So,
have you ever had any close calls?
Oh, of course. Yeah, I've had lots of close calls. Fortunately, not here in Binghamton. We had a very safe area, except for the wolves. But those weren't dangerous wolves at the time. But I've had most close calls I've had were in the wild. I remember being in South Africa and trying to like any tourist, I'm trying to get a good picture of a cheetah, and the cat kept. And I thought, and I'm thinking to myself, oh, he's just bluffing me. This cat came running right at me, knocked the lens right off my camera with one swipe. A wild cheetah. That was pretty sweet. What else? So I was in the Amazon, and I was swimming. This was actually pretty scary. I was swimming with pink dolphins, and believe it or not, there's an actual pink dolphin, a freshwater dolphin, that lives in the Amazon River. And I had a pink dolphin grab my leg and pull me under. They were just messing with me, but that was a pretty scary moment. Elephants, they're one of the most dangerous animals to work around. I've had a couple of close calls with elephants. Leopard one time.
And why elephants? What?
Well, elephants, just because of their size. It's a 9,000-pound animal that, and they're just highly intelligent. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, in zoology, we've never had elephants here at the Binghamton Zoo, but some zoos around the country, and they're kind of moving away from keeping, because they're such a large animal, requires so much care and in space, and plus they're so intelligent. You have to put so much work into maintaining their psychological and their social well-being as much as their physical well-being. Elephants are just intelligent. I remember I had an elephant, and this was so funny. I'm sitting there watching. We gave an elephant a watermelon, and he crushed it like a vice. And then all of a sudden, I wasn't paying attention. The elephant started putting my head in his mouth, and all I'm thinking is, I just saw what he did to that watermelon.
Right.
Can you imagine what you... And I just got my head out of there as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
So,
what are your thoughts about the circus?
The circus, for as much as people, it's been this American institution and all this stuff, I think it's, the more I think about it, I think its time is come and gone. I think it's something, or it just needs to evolve in something else. My thoughts with, You know, because we were talking about elephants, and you know, Ringling Brothers—they finally decided to retire their elephant. And I don't think Ringling Brothers is even doing a circus anymore. Yeah. You know, for many years, it's part of Americana. It's, you know, it's of a different time. You know, I'm more in zoological realm. I can appreciate the circus for what it is, but you know, I think its time has come and gone. But with that being said, I don't feel that, you know, that the, what do you call it, like the, this, I wouldn't demonize the circus for the elephants and other animals. Those animals are very well taken care of for the most part, and you know, and what I've seen, and I've seen some of the facilities that Ringling Brothers has down in Florida, and it's just, and they do contribute to conservation and contribute to public awareness in the same way as, you know, people are starting to you know, turn their backs on SeaWorld and parks like that too, where, you know, perhaps the way they've been doing things for years, time to change. I don't think that they should be demonized or closed or anything like that. Just maybe figure out a different way to modernize their thinking as well as their operations when working with such intelligent animals like elephants and marine mammals.
Sure. Jared, has technology played into or had a role in zoos more recently? In any capacity as far as, you know, just being helpful with temperature control and things like that.
Absolutely.
I mean,
you know,
we don't think typically, you know, the average person, we're not thinking about these things, but I could only imagine.
Right. Well, it's amazing. That's a fantastic question. I mean, technology, believe it or not, does more for zoological work and conservation than many would think. Coming from the point of conservation work with breeding, now we have the capability of, with artificial inseminations and sperm banks and figuring out genetics of animals, and it's all based on new technology. That's all has made a lot of, not only a lot of new techniques come to light, but also has helped not only reproduce but make lives better for animals as well. Plus, too, and I think even from a zoo perspective, the zoo experience, technology plays a lot. I mean, now you can have you can watch an animal from your phone. I always loved the animal cams, and I think at the time we were moving towards doing that at the zoo as well. I think when we got our Binghamton Bearcat, we wanted to have a Bearcat or something. Yes. So, but that's a good visitor experience use of technology. But of course, I mean, it takes quite a bit to, you know, because working with wild animals, especially, I mean, they can't speak. So you need to learn by just watching their behavior and relying on science to keep these guys healthy and happy and breeding and exhibit them appropriately where, you know, where all their physical needs are met, but also that they're not stressed.
We've
always done a really great job of that, especially our zoo here in Binghamton.
I remember one of the board members, Ron Green. His mission was to get a polar bear here.
Yeah, I know.
And I know it never happened, but, you know, all joking aside, what would it take to get a polar bear?
You know, we worked, I mean, Ron and I discussed that. We had so many ideas. And what was kind of fun, we always had these big dreams but at the zoo, but it was always like, we had our dreams, but we're also, and Ron and you as well, we're always putting out and solving problems and putting out fires. And we finally got the zoo to the point where we can move forward with just the expansion. But what it would take to get a polar bear, it's you know, they become a threatened species now. And in fact, I was just in a debate about polar bears at the museum. But to have captivity, it does take quite a bit of, quite a large enclosure. They're highly aquatic, so you would need a large pool, something where a viewing area. At Buffalo Zoo, we have polar bears. And I think Binghamton would do well with them because we have very similar climates. And I think a polar bear would do great in Binghamton, or a pair at least. But I think it would be a matter of if a polar bear needs a home. Typically, zoos keeping polar bears in captivities either for a breeding project or in some cases, nuisance bears or bears that might be orphaned, you know, in northern part of North America where they're found closest to the Arctic Circle, that would be if that opportunity came up, that bear could come to Binghamton if we had the facilities for it.
So, I see.
Yeah. Not impossible by any means.
Okay. So yeah. we'll
think about it. That might be
we'll
something
keep it
fun.
On there, right?
Maybe I'll come back and I'll bring a polar bear with
That's
me.
Right. Do you have a love for birds?
Mm-hmm. I do love birds, which is funny. I mean, you know, I don't get an opportunity to work with a lot of birds a lot, but I love birds of prey. one of my favorites. When I was a kid, I was always fascinated with the art of falconry, which is, or the sport of falconry, where, you know, actually hunting with, I'm not a big hunter myself. I love fishing, but not a big hunter, but I could see myself hunting with a bird. I think that'd be really fun. And that's just, and that's a really neat relationship that you can have with almost a wild animal.
Walk us through that. How would something
falconry,
like that work?
You know, it's something, what's interesting, it's one of the most ancient sports. I mean, kings have been doing it. I mean, even today, like, it's a sport of royalty. And actually, I have a buddy, one of my Instagram friends. I talk to him once in a while. He's in Saudi Arabia, and we talk about falconry, and I learn from him. And it's really just taking a bird of prey. A falcon typically works the best, or a hawk. And you start by training the bird to fly to you. And how you do that is all with positive reinforcement, with feeding it little morsels of food. And eventually, you know, these birds, you can send a falcon out, and he'll go capture you know, a pigeon or something, and bring it back to you. And it's really, really quite amazing. You know, if they didn't catch anything, I wouldn't care. Just the fact of seeing these birds, you know, out flying with them, and then having that connection with a wild animal where they actually just come back to you, it's really amazing.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So I would like to do that.
But I love, I know, isn't that sound fun? And you can do that. I mean, you know, there's master, not many, but there are master falconers throughout New York, and it's a, you have to apprentice for a while, and then you become a, and then there's, you know, state and federal permits that you need to earn to do this, but once you do, what an amazing thing. Yeah. Other birds, you know, I love, you know, I always have my I have raised a crow once. I love that because he had so much personality and talk. I think you might have met Nigel before.
Yes.
I had him here in Binghamton.
Yes.
When
that's
I was here
right.
for a little. And that was fun. I loved it when I came to Binghamton. Steve Contento, who was the interim director, and he's been back, I think, back and forth a few times. He goes, we were talking. I told him about some of the animals, like Mowgli the lemur and the crow. And he goes, well, I'll just bring him to the zoo. So that was my first introduction when I came to Binghamton. It was like everyone was pretty excited, you know, and very welcoming. And I really had such a great, you know, great experience. So
what about eagles?
Oh, I love eagles. Yeah, I'm working right now with an organization in the Buffalo area called Hawk Creek, where they started out rehabilitating a lot of native birds, but in the past year started working on breeding projects with different species of eagles. They bred eagles for release, and now we're working with some more rare exotic eagles from Africa. And right now I had the opportunity to help raise a little chick right now.
No kidding. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
That's pretty amazing.
Jared, what advice would you give for youngsters mm-hmm. who may be interested in a career?
You know, that's a great question too. You know, any kid that, you know, me, I just did whatever it took to do it. And I think, you know, and kids that want to pursue a field, either they really want to do it or they really don't. And that's what I found, because it's a lot of work, it's a lot of sacrifice, but it's the most rewarding career path you can choose, working with animals at any capacity, whether it be on a farm or an animal shelter at a zoo, out in the wild being a field researcher. I mean, there's so many directions within working with animals that I think there's something for everybody at one capacity. I mean, you could be an accountant for a zoo if you wanted to be,
sure.
You know, or, you know, but it's, but I think any advice to a kid is, a lot of it's just experience, you know, start young, you know, and create opportunities. Don't wait for someone to do it for you. Don't wait to do this. You know, if you want to get a job at the zoo, start volunteering at the zoo and then eventually work your way up. If you want to work with dogs, go find a dog trainer and become their apprentice. You know, it's just, you know, be, you know, just put yourself out and put yourself out there, and you'll get whatever you want.
Good advice.
Yeah.
Any regrets?
You know, a lot. You know, one regret is, I think, pertaining to Binghamton, I regret leaving when I did. When I decided to leave the zoo, we had done so much work, and, you know, obviously between having, you know, I had a death in the family, and, you know, I had some other career opportunities, but I think at that time we put so much work to get it right to the point, and we prepared for everything, that I love that all that success eventually came true for the zoo with, you know, after I left, but it would have been great to be a part of that, like a lot of that new construction and a lot of the stuff that we did, a lot of that funding we secured, a lot of, you know, the staffing reorganization, all that stuff that we did leading up, because at that time it's like, you have to deal with what you're doing. That was the most interesting dynamic of that job, like any business, where you're making the decisions day to day to solve the problems day to day, but the decisions you make too, you need to think about sustainability and what's your decision today going to do and affect 10 years from now. And, you know what I mean? So that's what it always was. So that was my, that was probably one of my regrets, because, you know, I still you never lose that passion for that kind of work. So
was that the most pressure you were ever under?
No, I've been in far more pressure before that and after. I mean, there's a lot of pressure in television to deliver and that, but that was a lot of pressure. I mean, for a young person especially, you know, that's a lot coming at you, and it's a lot. And especially when everything goes great, there's a lot of pressure when you're working on projects, but there was just so, I mean, as you well know, there were so many problems and so many things, but there was an excitement in that, and believe it or not, you thrive for that pressure sometimes.
Yeah.
And then when that pressure is gone, you kind of crave it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you agree with with your business opportunities too.
Absolutely.
It's fun. I guess that's the definition of ambition.
Sure.
Or, you know.
What do you attribute to your success in this field?
You know, I mean, I guess I don't know what the definition of success. I mean, I think personal success is when you work at something and you work and it doesn't feel like work. Don't you agree?
Yes.
Where it's just you enjoy something so much that it's not like your alarm goes off and you're not dreading it. Your alarm goes off and you wake up excited to do it. And I felt that when I was at the Binghamton Zoo. I feel that working on my television programs. I feel that, you know, coming here to talk with you and stuff. You know, I mean, it's, you know, I think if you can find enjoyment in whatever you do, then that's the true definition of success.
Great. Jared, this has been fantastic. We've had a great conversation. I knew we would. But before I let you go, I have one last question for you. What do you want your legacy to be?
You know, my legacy, I think my legacy would be something to either a place like a zoo, like something to really put your mark on, or maybe an animal named after it. Maybe discovering an animal would be cool. Or, you know, we live in such an age of technology, I think, you know, much like yourself, like maybe just create something that brings something to people's lives that, you know, that will inspire the next thing. I mean, I don't mind ever being forgotten, but, and I guess that's the opposite of a legacy, but as long as your actions or something you did inspire the next great thing to happen. So that's what I hope.
Wonderful. Well, this has been great. Jared Miller, thanks so much for coming
on
American Real, and now you're part of the family.
All right, fantastic.
Thanks so much.
Good seeing you.
I love story. Our lives are story. We engage through story. Now that I am doing American Real, I am able to help tell other people's stories. And there's an art to that. I want people to be inspired by the content. And it's not me, it's the guest. I want them to learn from the guests, as I'm learning from the guests. And once you start to see progress, to me, it's motivating and makes you want to work harder to get to the next piece. Now you're pushing us to record episodes. So I had guests in and I'm learning the technology. And of course, we had many challenges and lots of resistance, but I don't know, you know, you just persevere, because when you have a passion for something, you find a way to get it done. I think the biggest breakthrough, I would say, after episode 3. And the guests, you know, a couple of guests came up to me after saying, thank you for that interview. This was the best interview of my life. That's when I knew, okay, I'm on the right track. I need to keep doing this. I need to tell people's stories. Don't be afraid to put yourself out there. Don't be afraid to be vulnerable, because when you do it, you'll be surprised the response that you receive.